KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
People are confused and people are hurt. And so I'm telling the Panamanians that they need to take this deadly seriously.
Panamanians insist their canal is not for sale, even as President Trump says the U.S. plans to take it.
From Monday, February 3rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro, hosting from the edge of the Panama Canal.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Trump says he'll pause tariffs against Mexico in exchange for the Mexican National Guard helping out at the border.
We don't think equity markets would really like 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico. This might just be more of a negotiation tactic.
And we'll talk with one of the lawmakers trying to get access to USAID headquarters.
Plus, climate change is boosting the rat population in cities.
Cities that have experienced temperature warming saw faster increases in rat numbers.
Later, a Goodwill store that serves and employs women in county jail.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans living in the U.S. may soon lose their temporary legal status under new regulations released by the Trump administration. NPR's Greg Allen reports in Florida, Venezuelan-American leaders are calling the TPS policy change a betrayal and plan to challenge it in court.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem says renewing temporary protected status for more than 300,000 Venezuelans is, quote, contrary to the national interest. That comes as a blow to Venezuelans who came to the U.S. seeking refuge from the authoritarian Nicolas Maduro regime and now face possible deportation. Adelis Ferro, with the Venezuelan-American Caucus, says her community is shocked and disappointed.
During the campaign, the elected officials from the Republican Party, they actually told us that he was not going to touch the documented people.
TPS designations are generally 6 to 18 months, but repeated extensions are not uncommon. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
As head of DOGE, President Trump's team tasked with slashing federal spending, Elon Musk says his mandate includes shutting down the U.S. Agency for International Development. NPR's Shannon Bond reports DOGE's actions are causing chaos at federal agencies and raising security and legal questions.
Elon Musk says he has President Trump's backing in what he described as, quote, feeding USAID into the wood chipper. But Democrats and legal experts say it's not clear DOGE can dismantle a federal agency without congressional approval. They're also raising alarms over reports DOGE staff have gained access to classified USAID material and to a key Treasury payment system. The White House says Musk has been named a special government employee, which is a temporary appointment to perform, quote, limited services. It's not clear what the status of other people working at DOGE is or whether they have security clearances. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
A Georgia judge is dismissing one of two charges against a former prosecutor accused of interfering with a police investigation into the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. As NPR's Debbie Elliott reports, Arbery was the black jogger chased and killed by three white men in 2020, but no arrests were made until months later.
Ruling from the bench, senior judge John Turner said there was, quote, not one scintilla of evidence supporting an obstruction charge against former Brunswick District Attorney Jackie Johnson. She still faces a felony charge of violating her oath of office. Prosecutors with the Georgia State Attorney General's office say Johnson sought to shield Arbery's killers from arrest. One of them had previously worked as an investigator in her office. The judge's directed verdict came after prosecutors rested their case, having presented no testimony that Johnson tried to influence police. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
The Dow was down 122 points. This is NPR. 2 weeks into the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, aid is flowing back into the war-torn region again. Supplies offering some relief to an area devastated by 15 months of fighting. But Palestinian aid workers say it's also been an uphill battle getting help to everyone who needs it. There also remains the possibility fighting will resume if the ceasefire breaks down. Further complicating things, getting the aid to those who need it most are destroyed roads and unexploded ordnance. The number of Americans who use cannabis has doubled over the last decade. That's according to a survey by Gallup. But NPR found it's still difficult for many Americans to find marijuana that's legally sourced with proper consumer protections. More from NPR's Brian Mann.
For a lot of people in the U.S., using cannabis feels as normal as drinking a glass of wine or beer. But a dozen years after states started legalizing recreational cannabis, regulatory oversight is still a confusing patchwork. The drug is still illegal federally, and it's often difficult for consumers to distinguish between legal weed and cannabis produced by illegal growers and criminal gangs. Bo Kilmer studies marijuana markets for the RAND Corporation.
When you move from prohibition to legalization, you know, it takes time to significantly reduce the size of the illegal market.
Cannabis experts say they expect legal weed will eventually push out black market products. Brian Mann, NPR News.
With President Trump imposing tariffs or talking about imposing them on allies and trading partners alike, members of the European Union say they're bracing for similar possible treatment. EU leaders meeting in Brussels today for what is billed as a defense summit. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro at the edge of the Panama Canal. This is a spot that has sat at the center of global trade for more than a century, connecting two oceans. The things Americans use every day pass through here, from cars to food. And now, this spot is also at the center of President Trump's global expansionist agenda. This morning, Secretary of State Marco Rubio wrapped up a visit to Panama, and here's what his boss, President Trump, said yesterday.
China's running the Panama Canal. That was not given to China, that was given to Panama foolishly, but they violated the agreement, and we're going to take it back or something very powerful is going to happen.
His claim that China operates the canal is false, and we'll dig into that more in a minute. When Rubio woke up here in Panama City yesterday morning, he went to services at a church where cameras were not allowed. But a different Sunday morning service live-streamed into Panamanians' homes all over the country. Archbishop Jose Domingo Ulloa offered a homily that gives you a sense of how Panamanians are feeling right now.
La soberanía, el buen nombre de Panamá. No se regala ni se negocia.
Sovereignty and the good name of Panama are not given away or negotiated, he said from the pulpit. They are defended with determination and love for the homeland. Trump's focus on the canal has brought out a nationalistic streak here in Panama. The country's flag flutters along roadsides, on buildings, and in front yards. Panamanians told me they don't even see this many flags on Independence Day. After Sunday morning services, Secretary Rubio met with Panama's President Jose Raul Mulino. Here's how the president described that meeting.
No sentí para nada un clima de controversia, ni un clima de irrespeto.
I didn't feel any sense of controversy, just a climate of respect, he said. The State Department described things differently. According to a spokesperson's statement, Rubio told Mulino that President Trump has made a preliminary determination that China has too much influence over the canal, which he says violates international treaties. The statement continued, quote, absent immediate changes, it would require the United States to take measures necessary to protect its rights. Rubio did not comment publicly on the meeting. President Mulino told reporters he's happy to discuss immigration and drug trafficking, but the canal is not up for debate.
La soberanía de Panamá no está en cuestión. Eso es muy importante.
Panama's sovereignty is not in question. That is very important, he said. Panamanians will tell you that this fight is about identity, neocolonialism, and whether strong countries can push around weaker ones. And that may all be true, but narrowly speaking, this fight is specifically about a 51-mile waterway that is essential to global commerce. 40% of U.S. maritime traffic passes through this canal. Panama fully took control of the passage in 1999, but when President Jimmy Carter signed those treaties back in 1977, He said the agreements showed the kind of leader he wanted the U.S. to be.
They mark the commitment of the United States to the belief that fairness and not force should lie at the heart of our dealings with the nations of the world.
That line about fairness, not force, is so meaningful to Panama, it is actually on a metal plaque at the base of a statue in the heart of this city. In 2016, Panama expanded the canal, and now about 35 ships pass through daily. The U.S. accounts for more than three-quarters of the traffic. This is one of the few places in the world where you actually want to be on a sinking ship.
Be welcome to one of the wonders of the world. Be welcome to the Panama Canal.
The visitor center at the Miraflores Locks may be the best place to see the canal in action. Picture three enormous steps. Millions of gallons of water flood into or out of the locks to float massive ships one step at a time from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic or vice versa. Tourists from all over the world come here. Most of the Panamanians you meet at the Miraflores Locks are hosting folks from out of town, like Edwin Scott, who brought a friend from Mexico to show off his country's pride and joy. For a Panamanian, there's just no words, he says. The canal is the most important institution we have. He believes this fight isn't really about Panama. He thinks his country just had the bad luck to get caught between two giants, the U.S. and China. I think Mr. Trump has this psychosis with Chinese people. There aren't Chinese people in the canal, he says. What do you think will happen? I don't know, because he's obsessed with the Chinese people, Scott says. So back to China's role here. There is no truth to Trump's claim that China operates the canal, but a company based in Hong Kong called CK Hutchison Holdings operates two of the five ports surrounding the canal. We asked the company for an interview and they declined. We also requested interviews with the Canal Authority, Secretary Rubio, the President of Panama, and the Mayor of Panama City. The fact that none of them agreed may be a sign of just how delicate this moment is. So to clarify some of the facts here, I called Ambassador John Feely. He's a career diplomat and former U.S. ambassador to Panama. Appointed late in the Obama administration, he stayed in the role for 2 years under Trump. He still knows lots of people in Panama, and he says this controversy caught them all off guard.
And so I'm telling the Panamanians that they need to take this deadly seriously.
He says he's been warning about China's influence in Latin America since at least 2017.
I tried to get the Trump administration to pay a lot more attention to Panama's recognition of Beijing, and I got nothing.
So without being inflammatory, what is the threat that China poses to the United States in Panama?
The threat is not military. The two port concessions that a Hong Kong-based company operate do not have the military logistical capability to shut the canal down. The canal is run by an independent agency in Panama.
He says the threat from China is more subtle. It's about economic engagement, and it stretches far beyond the Panama Canal to places all over the region where China is investing and the U.S. is not. In protests all over the city, Panamanians made their feelings clear. In one, construction workers burned an American flag in the middle of a major street. At another, a woman showed up at the finish line pushing a cart. She shaved a massive block of ice into snow cones topped with condensed milk and fruit syrups. The teachers' union organized this demonstration.
El canal es de los panameños y así se va a mantener.
The canal is ours, says a high school art teacher named Marlenis Nunez.
Nos va a tener que matar a todos. Somos pequeños, pero tenemos un gran corazón.
He'll have to kill us all, she says. We are small, but we have a huge heart.
You are a teacher. You are not a soldier.
No, pero estoy dispuesta a defender a mi canal.
No, but I'm willing to defend my canal, she says. Panama was the first country Rubio visited as Secretary of State, but he kept a low profile, saying nothing publicly about the canal through all of his meetings and events yesterday. By the time he did say something on the record about the canal, he was in El Salvador, and he mostly reiterated what President Trump had already said. We'll be hearing voices from Panama all throughout the show today as we continue hosting All Things Considered from the edge of the Panama Canal.
One of President Trump's arguments in favor of trade wars with Canada, China, and Mexico is fentanyl. Trump says all three countries must do more to stop deadly street fentanyl from entering the U.S. But many of the things that Trump says about the fentanyl crisis are either false or greatly exaggerated. NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann joins us now to talk through this. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so what does President Trump say these three countries are essentially doing wrong?
Yeah, so Trump has said repeatedly that carnage from fentanyl could be stopped if China cuts off supplies of precursor chemicals used to make fentanyl, and if Mexico and Canada clamp down on criminal gangs and help tighten border security. Trump says drug deaths are claiming, this is his assertion, between 250 and 300,000 lives in the U.S. every year. And on Friday, White House spokeswoman Carolyn Leavitt said Canada, China, and Mexico are together responsible for tens of millions of fentanyl deaths.
Okay, and I know that you've been fact-checking those statements. What did you find?
Well, look, fentanyl has been devastating, but President Trump is inflating annual drug deaths roughly threefold, and there are nowhere close to tens of millions of deaths from fentanyl or other drugs, as Carolyn Leavitt has suggested. We don't know where those numbers are coming from, but the latest data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it actually shows all drug deaths, including fentanyl, have been dropping fast. They're down about 21% since 2023, and really those are unprecedented improvements.
What about the claim that these countries should be pressured to do more to stop fentanyl smuggling? Like, let's start with Canada.
Well, in a statement today, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said his country will try to crack down more on fentanyl, and they'll list drug cartels as terrorist organizations. But, you know, factually, Elsa, Canada plays no meaningful role in the U.S. fentanyl crisis. Last year, fewer than 50 pounds of fentanyl were seized at the Canadian border. That compares with about 21,000 pounds on the Mexican border. Trudeau's statement appeared aimed at convincing Trump to delay tariffs, and it worked. They've paused for 30 days.
All right, well, if Canada's not a factor, what about the role of China and Mexico?
Yeah, U.S. officials and drug policy experts say for years, Chinese and Mexican officials took a hands-off approach to fentanyl. They described it as an American problem, and that created a lot of bipartisan ill will in the U.S. But here's what's interesting. Over the last 2 years, there's been a change. You know, under pressure from the Biden administration, U.S. officials say China began regulating chemical companies more closely. President Claudia Sheinbaum of Mexico has been ordering more raids against the cartels. They've been breaking up drug labs and seizing more fentanyl.
And were those efforts actually helping?
Well, lawmakers in both parties here in the U.S. say China and Mexico can still do a lot more. And under pressure from President Trump's tariff threat, Mexico did announce today more National Guard troops will go to the border to help with security. But what we know from the DEA is fentanyl smuggling into the U.S. was already dropping sharply before this trade war, down last year by roughly 20%.
That is NPR's Brian Mann. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. In Washington today, protesters gathered outside the office of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. They were there to object to the so-called Department of Government Efficiency's move to effectively shutter the agency. In that crowd were a number of lawmakers, including Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland.
And just like Elon Musk did not create USAID, he doesn't have the power to destroy it. And who's going to stop him? We are. We're going to stop him.
Well, Congressman Raskin joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us. So explain to me the main reason so many Democrats are speaking out against this.
Well, Congress set up government AID, the Agency for International Development, many decades ago. Congress authorized it. Congress appropriates the money, and it is implementing congressional programs to support U.S. foreign policy and democracy and development all over the world, like HIV, AIDS prevention efforts in Africa, anti-malaria campaigns all over the world, malaria nets, you name it. We're in Ukraine repairing the electrical infrastructure destroyed by Putin. And so this is a move that really fortifies the autocrats of the world, and it completely violates the U.S. Constitution. So it really cannot stand.
And I heard that you were not able to get into the building today. What were you trying to achieve exactly, or what were you trying to find by trying to gain access into the building today?
Well, I represent thousands of federal workers, and a lot of them work in foreign aid and at USAID, and I wanted to go and see what's happening. They told me they were locked out of their workplace, and sure enough, we got inside, and they said it had been closed, and all of the workers there were told to be teleworking, which is also, I understand, against the law under one of Trump's new executive orders. But it's an attempt really to shut down an essential government function. And, you know, this is billions of dollars of work that is being done all over the world, and they're trying to disrupt it and block it. And it comes from Elon Musk, and we don't know exactly what authority he's operating under.
Do you believe the Trump administration is breaking the law with this move to try to shut down USAID without congressional approval? Is that your position?
I have no doubt. It's just like, you know, they're threatening now to dismantle the Department of Education, or they're threatening to dismantle HHS or the Department of State. I mean, they can no more do any of those things than they can do this. These agencies and the departments exist by congressional lawmaking. It is the role of the executive branch simply to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, not that they're consistently undermined and destroyed. That's true of the president, much less of a guy who's never been elected to anything and has never been confirmed for anything. I understand that Elon Musk is a special government employee at Doge. Or whatever they call it, the first federal department named after a crypto coin.
But not officially a federal department, right? Well, let me ask you this. No. Would you use the phrase constitutional crisis in this moment? Because those are the words of Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. You were a professor of constitutional law. Would you use the same characterization as he does?
Well, we're certainly in a political crisis right now because they're trampling the Constitution. But I believe that we've got the resiliency within our constitutional framework to shut this down. I mean, there are thousands of federal workers whose civil service rights are being violated right now. FBI agents, government prosecutors,
How would you try to shut this down? I mean, like, how can Democrats respond here other than sharing concerns openly, as you are, and trying to maybe hold up nominations? What other tools do Democratic lawmakers such as yourself even have?
Well, it's a longer conversation because a lot of these are going to be civil service lawsuits. Some of them are going to be constitutional lawsuits. Some are going to be statutory, like the inspectors general who got sacked en masse, 17 or 18 of them, last week. That violates a federal law which says that Congress must be notified 30 days before an IG is fired with a specific substantive justification for why they're being fired. That was completely ignored and violated. We've got civil service employees at the Department of Justice who are being sacked simply because they worked on the January 6th cases. Clearly political retaliation and retaliation against them.
But you see litigation as the main tool here.
Litigation is a major tool. Public education is a major tool. We are going to try to mobilize a mass movement in the country to force them to back off of these attacks on the Constitution and the rule of law.
That is Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland. Thank you so much, Congressman.
My pleasure.
Rats have spread far and wide thanks to what humans do. We leave out trash, we provide shelter. Now add climate change to that list. A new study shows that warmer temperatures are helping rat populations grow in cities. Lauren Sommer reports from NPR's Climate Desk.
Rats have a lot in common with people. They love pizza, they love the homes we build, and they don't love cold temperatures.
When the weather gets cold, that's a bigger challenge for these guys. Maintaining their own stable body temperature.
Jonathan Richardson is a biology professor at the University of Richmond. He studies how rats are so successful at living with people.
Rats are fascinating creatures, but they come with very big issues. They transmit at least 50 known zoonotic pathogens that can make us sick. They damage our infrastructure. We certainly don't like them when they're in our house.
So cities spend a lot of time trying to control rats. Richardson and his colleagues looked at 16 cities to see what made rat populations grow. They found the more urbanized a city is, and the more people there are, the more rats there are. But climate change has also helped rats.
Cities that have experienced more temperature warming saw faster increases in rat numbers.
That's likely because rats aren't out searching for food as much when it's cold, Richardson says.
If the weather stays warmer a little bit later into the fall or into the winter, if the spring starts a little bit earlier, just by a week or two, that should allow the rats to be above ground, forage for a little bit longer, secure more food resource, and presumably turn that into baby rats, right?
And more rat babies means more problems for cities.
It's a problem that's going to require more resources.
Kaylee Byers is an assistant professor at Simon Fraser University who was not involved in the research. She says it's a useful look at how the climate affects rats.
I definitely think we need to be thinking about how our changing cities are going to impact rat populations, and climate change is one part of that.
Byers says it's really tough to know how many rats are out there. This study uses rat complaints from the public to gauge that. So better monitoring of rats would give an even clearer picture of how climate change is affecting them. And the strategies to manage rats still aren't great.
We're often sort of focused on this like see a rat, kill a rat mentality, but like, spoiler, that's not working, right?
The problem is us, Beyer says, and the way we manage our food waste and trash. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration is dismantling federal diversity efforts while some local and state governments continue right on.
Do not obey in advance. We don't yet know how these executive orders will actually affect you.
DEI in local government, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Many people whose homes burned in the LA wildfires lost their insurance coverage and relied on last resort plans that cover much less.
Our insurance doesn't cover cost of living, so all of it will be out of pocket. And we're really lucky to have a GoFundMe that's helping with that.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. On Capitol Hill, some Democratic members of Congress are speaking out against efforts by the Trump administration to halt nearly all of the work of the U.S. Agency for International Development. NPR's Hansi Luong tells us Trump officials are pushing the limits of executive power at the federal agency.
Demonstrators gathered outside the Washington, D.C. headquarters of USAID. Democratic Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland says he's concerned how the Trump administration's efforts are upending initiatives to stop the spread of viruses globally.
This is a killer in terms of their cutoff of HIV and AIDS preemption. It's a killer in terms of anti-malarial education.
Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat from Minnesota, says USAID's work affects families in refugee camps like the ones she grew up in.
It is the essential programs that USAID provided that kept my family and I fed and safe.
Some USAID supporters say they expect lawsuits challenging the Trump administration's authority to terminate an independent government agency. Hansi Luong, NPR News, Washington.
Meanwhile, federal law enforcement groups are urging Congress to step in and stop a possible purge at the FBI. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports the dismissal could disrupt the Bureau's work.
The groups say the possible termination of thousands of FBI agents who worked on Capitol riot cases is creating a dangerous distraction. Losing even some of those federal agents could imperil ongoing investigations and undermine the FBI's ability to support local authorities. The law enforcement groups say any review of agents should follow normal policy and give those agents due process. The FBI has been in turmoil since new temporary leaders in the Justice Department signaled they may want to fire agents who worked on sensitive cases. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks finished lower across the board on Wall Street. This is NPR. Scientists have developed a device that uses pulses of electricity to treat rheumatoid arthritis. NPR's John Hamilton tells us it could offer a way to reduce inflammation without drugs.
The implanted device delivers electrical pulses to the vagus nerve, which connects the brain with internal organs and the immune system. Dr. Kevin Tracy of Northwell Health in New York says the pulses trigger a reflex that puts the brakes on inflammation in joints.
Neural signals have the ability to reflexively control aspects of the immune system that, frankly, nobody had thought about before.
A study of 242 patients with rheumatoid arthritis found that the device, made by SetPoint Medical, was able to reduce pain and inflammation and slow the damage in affected joints. The Food and Drug Administration is reviewing the device and is likely to make a decision by the end of the year. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Well, more than a dozen members of Congress are starting an investigation into erroneous emergency alerts that went out last month to millions of cell phones during the L.A. wildfires. Alerts were critical, of course, during the worst wildfires in the city's history, but there was at least one mistaken alert that went out to all 10 million residents here in L.A. County, telling everybody to evacuate, but most people were nowhere near the fires and not in danger. A correction was sent out moments later. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow, planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at DignityMemorial.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Panama.
And I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California. All right, break out the margaritas or the Canadian whiskey. A threatened tax on imports from Mexico and Canada is on hold, at least for now. President Trump agreed to suspend the tariffs for at least 1 month after his counterparts promised new measures to safeguard their borders to the north and south of the U.S. Trump is still threatening a 10% tariff on imports from China, but the prospect of a wider trade war has drawn stiff opposition from U.S. business groups. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so all of these tariffs were set to take effect tomorrow, right? But Trump has offered a temporary reprieve, at least when it comes to Mexico and Canada. Everything's happened so fast. Can you just, like, bring us up to speed here?
Sure. Trump was pleased that Mexico agreed to send National Guard troops to help police the southern border. Canada is also taking some steps to ostensibly curb the flow of illegal fentanyl and immigration, which was Trump's stated rationale for these tariffs. Beyond those concessions, if you want to call them that, the president also got a pretty strong signal from the stock market this morning that investors didn't like the idea of launching a trade war against the country's next-door neighbors, who are also the United States' biggest trading partners.
Yeah.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled more than 600 points in the first half hour of trading this morning. And Matthew Martin of Oxford Economics says that's the kind of thing that gets Trump's attention.
Trump uses the equity markets as kind of a guidepost of, are his policies working? In this case, we don't think equity markets would really like 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico. This might just be more of a negotiation tactic.
Stocks largely rebounded once it became evident that a deal to suspend the tariffs was in the works. The president also got an earful from industry groups who warned that tariffs would drive up prices in the U.S. and invite retaliation that could hurt U.S. exporters. You know, over the weekend, the powerful business lobby, the Chamber of Commerce, along with the National Association of Manufacturers and the Farm Bureau Federation, all came out strongly against these import taxes.
Well, just how worried were those businesses? Did they think it was a bluff, maybe?
Well, they were worried that the tariffs would have ended decades of free trade in North America. You know, I talked to a farmer this morning in northeastern Iowa, a state that Trump carried handily back in November. Bob Hemisoth worried that if tariffs had taken effect, he would have had to pay more for the fertilizer he imports from Canada and also lost sales. You know, he notes the last time Trump launched a trade war, China pretty much stopped buying corn and hogs from the U.S.
They went to South America, to Brazil and Argentina. And once you lose those markets, those export markets, as a supplier or an exporter, it's awful hard to get them back.
So there's a lot of relief that the tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada have been paused, at least temporarily. Of course, we're still going to have uncertainty for the next 30 days, but at least for now, North America remains a free trade zone.
For now, that is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome.
We are hosting the show today from the edge of the Panama Canal. President Trump says the U.S. was foolish to give it away, and he wants it back. The new Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, wrapped up a trip to Panama today. In a meeting with the country's president, he apparently delivered an ultimatum: get China's influence out of the canal, or the U.S. will do what it has to. Well, our next guest is the man who used to oversee this 51-mile waterway connecting the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. Jorge Luis Quijano was the canal administrator from 2012 to 2019. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Glad to be here.
Secretary Rubio just left this morning. Are you feeling better or worse about the situation than before his visit?
Well, I think we expected a little bit more detail of what was really behind President Trump's accusations and misinterpretations. And
more detail, like specifically what concessions
what do you
the
want,
U.S. wanted?
You know, because yeah. I really don't think that he intends to invade Panama once again, not him, but the U.S. So I believe that there's more to what he's saying that he really is expecting Panama to somehow come to terms with.
He did not offer the details, as you say, but this statement from the State Department was pretty pointed. If I may quote you from it, it says, "This status quo is unacceptable, and absent immediate changes, it would require the United States to take measures necessary to protect its rights." What kind of immediate changes could you imagine Panama offering that might appease President Trump?
Well, I'm not going to speak for the government. I'm now retired, and I can only say that the statements that have been made are incorrect.
There
are,
about
Chinese involvement. Yes, there are some Chinese contractors here doing some work, but like them, you know, this is an international waterway, and Panama is really international, and therefore you're going to have contractors from all over the place.
But as you know, there are these two ports operated by a company out of Hong Kong, which the State Department says opens the door to influence by the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, that's, I think, an speculation. When you make these accusations, you need to prove them. I have not seen any proof.
And yet Panama has begun an audit of those ports. Do you think that could be used as a pretense to seize control from these Hong Kong-based companies in order to satisfy President Trump?
I think if we go back, the audit was required to be done really very in deep when it was the renovation of the contract or the concession, which was back in 2022. And at that time, the Comptroller General, frankly speaking, I felt that he didn't do quite his job of actually coming up with a good audit. But these are all commercial issues that need to be audited. And the audit is because Panama owns 10% of that concession.
But I'm just trying to figure out what the off-ramp here is. If Trump is insistent that we will take the canal and Panama is insistent that this is non-negotiable, Panamanian land is sovereign, then how does this get resolved? Is it the audit? Is it concessions? You say you hope it's not an invasion. I think everyone hopes that. What is the ending?
Well, first of all, we haven't really spoken up. I mean, negotiations haven't really started. What is it that they really want? I mean, the U.S. wants, and what is it that Panama also wants? Because there's, you know, we've been partners with the United States forever. And yes, we have our ups and downs through time. But I'm surprised that right now with this president in particular, that he's actually improving on the migration into the United States by significant numbers, that cooperating with the U.S. And he's not really focusing on working together to do more positive things like that and like maybe drug interdiction. And other items. But
so you think maybe with drugs and with immigration, there's an opportunity to for Panama to say, we can help you, you can help, us, we can reach a solution here.
Yeah, but not only that, but I want to go back to the ports. Because, you know, he feels like the ports control the Panama Canal. And that's not the way it is.
All right.
To go, and you were right here next to the canal, and you know that to take a vessel from the anchorage to the port, you need first authorization from Marine Traffic Control, which is controlled by the Panama Canal. You also need a Panamanian pilot to go on board of the vessel and take full control of the vessel to take it to the port. So who is in control? We control. Panama controls the access to the ports or actually coming out of the port as well.
Jorge Luis Quijano was administrator of the Panama Canal from 2012 to 2019. Thank you so much for talking with us here today in Panama City.
Thank you for the invitation.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump praises one former president a lot these days.
President McKinley made our country very rich through tariffs and through talent. He was a natural businessman.
NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid reports on Trump's admiration for an unsung president.
In the late 19th century, William McKinley was a congressman from Ohio.
And he ushered through a tariff bill in 1890.
That's Douglas Irwin. He's an economics professor at Dartmouth College.
And it raised tariffs, not a huge amount, but they were already pretty high.
Keep in mind, at that time, there was no income tax, so the main source of revenue was tariffs. And the rate at that time was over 40%. Trump talks about this period in history as a kind of golden era for the United States. Here he was at a rally in Phoenix in December paying tribute to McKinley.
He was a strong believer in tariffs, and we were actually probably wealthiest of any time, relatively speaking, at any point in the history of our country.
But Irwin thinks Trump's depiction is not entirely accurate.
A lot of people, including President Trump, think that the strong manufacturing economy was due to the McKinley tariff. But actually, the 1890s was not a good decade for the U.S. economy. We had a major recession starting in 1893, and we had about 4 or 5 years of double-digit unemployment.
The U.S. economy as a whole did grow in the late 1800s, but it's hard to know if that was exclusively because of tariffs. This time period was also an age of rapid industrialization and immigration. And once McKinley was elected president in 1896, his own opinions on trade evolved. Here's Irwin again.
I think President Trump tends to downplay or ignore McKinley's turn to reciprocity late in his presidency, and that we needed harmonious, mutually beneficial trade agreements that would expand trade, not contract it.
But Trump's admiration for the 25th president of the United States also seems deeper than just tariffs. McKinley realigned and consolidated the power of the Republican Party for decades. And on Trump's first day back in office, he signed an executive order renaming North America's highest peak, Mount McKinley, and praised the former president for expanding America's footprint around the globe. Robert Mary wrote a book about McKinley.
He made America an empire for good or ill. He brought Hawaii into the fold as a result of annexation. He rescued Cuba from what was pretty terrible Spanish dominion. He pushed us into the Pacific with Guam and the Philippines.
He also took Puerto Rico as a colony. Trump has expressed interest in acquiring Greenland and the Panama Canal. But Justin Jackson, who's writing a new book on this time period, does not think McKinley was searching for territory to conquer.
William McKinley, you could think of as an accidental imperialist.
Jackson told me there are differences between McKinley and Trump's policies and temperament.
And so it's very odd that Trump has fixated on McKinley rather than Teddy Roosevelt, who is much more like Trump, full of braggadocio and hypermasculinity and eagerness for selectively taking other territories and expanding American trade.
Roosevelt became president when McKinley was assassinated in 1901, and he was the driving force behind the construction of the Panama Canal that Trump has threatened to reclaim. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Many fire victims in Los Angeles lost their homeowners insurance before they even lost their homes. Major companies like State Farm and Allstate have been pulling back from California as wildfires here have intensified. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
In a nearly empty rental house in East L.A. County, Sogol Moshfes is struggling to assemble an IKEA bunk bed for her two young boys.
Got those two bits done.
The family lost their home in the Altadena fire. They've just started moving in here. Order out lunch arrives.
Pizza time!
Last summer, like so many others in L.A.'s burn zones, Moshfes and her husband's insurance company said it would not renew their policy. When their broker called around to replace it,
she was like, I'm trying to get you insured, but your whole zip code is closed.
They ended up with a policy through their mortgage company, which was a relief, but they're only now realizing it covers a lot less than their old policy. It will pay for a rebuild, though likely only half the cost. She says it will not cover all the possessions they lost or the rent for this temporary place.
So all of it will be out of pocket, and we're really lucky to have a GoFundMe that's helping with that.
Looking back, Moshfes says she would have happily paid more to keep her old insurance policy. But the insurance industry says this is exactly why companies have been retreating from California. They are not allowed to charge enough to cover their risk.
The real issue is the inability to get adequate rates.
Mark Secknan is with the American Property Casualty Insurance Association. He says for decades, state regulation has kept rates artificially low. Brand new rules will allow insurers to raise rates, but they'll take time to roll out.
This is a risk-based product, and so those people who have the highest risk should actually pay more.
Meanwhile, with the exodus of big insurers over the past 2 years, independent brokers have scrambled to find companies that will protect people. Jake Pullen has dozens of clients in Pacific Palisades, and as the fire there exploded, he panicked. Was there any missing paperwork?
I was worried sick. Literally, my stomach was in knots. I was auditing all the zip codes that the fires were in, making sure that all my clients had policies.
Thankfully, his clients were all covered. Poland says he got about half of them enrolled in what's called the California Fair Plan. It was created by the state to be an insurer of last resort, but demand has skyrocketed. It costs more and covers less, with an all-inclusive payout capped at $3 million. For Michael Balsley and his family, whose Palisades home is completely gone, that means a major loss.
We would never be able to build the house as it was when we bought it, let alone what it was with all our belongings and improvements and things like that.
Balsley says when he and his wife bought the place, they did think about wildfires. They ruled out living next to a lush park that could ignite, but they never imagined fire would wipe out the village center. He'd like to see insurers and governments work out new options for living with this higher level of risk.
It's not fair to people who live in California to just not be insurable, because there's many places that I think are really safe. But for places like ours where there's a question, it would have been nice to say, well, what could make it insurable?
For Sogol Moshfes, the expense of rebuilding her family's home in Altadena is daunting. Their limited insurance means they'd have to take out another big loan while still paying their mortgage and years of rent.
I'm trying to be really optimistic about it, but there's like so much of me that's like, this is going to bankrupt us, and I don't want that to happen.
She says she still wants to be a homeowner again, but maybe not in California. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
A Goodwill store in the San Francisco Bay Area is exclusively serving and employing women in a county jail. Member station KQED's Brian Kranz reports from Milpitas, California.
On a recent Thursday, Blanca Hernandez helped Jessica Lemos pick out an outfit for a special occasion, her release from jail. They're both incarcerated at the Elmwood Correctional Facility in Santa Clara County, just north of San Jose.
No. Too tomboyish.
Yeah.
Maybe something a little more girly. Oh, this is cute.
Lemos isn't scheduled to be released from jail until May, but when she is, she'll leave with two outfits of her choosing, plus three packs of brand new underwear and socks.
This is a great opportunity because It's one less worry that I don't have to worry about, like, what am I going to wear when I leave here?
The Elmwood Goodwill store opened this past fall. A Goodwill spokesperson says it's the only Goodwill store in a correctional facility, and women on their way out of jail can shop there. The employees are all incarcerated, so for them, working at the store provides job training opportunities. The program is a partnership with Goodwill of Silicon Valley and the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office. Jenny Brooke is a rehabilitation officer with Santa Clara County.
It's an opportunity for them to get job skills and hands-on experience that is exactly going to be useful in the same stores in the community. So yeah, we call this a training store, really.
The store is housed in a nondescript white cinder block room on the jail's 62-acre campus. Each week, employees sort through a mountain of merchandise, inspecting hems, seams, zippers, and buttons to make sure everything is up to standard before making it onto the store's two clothing racks. Zyra is one of the store's employees. She asked that we only use her first name due to concerns about being identified given her criminal history. She goes through some of the brand name shoes available.
We have some Fila's, Crocs, Converse. We do have some Jordans, some Vans. We got some Aldo, we got some Gucci, and we got some Versace.
Upon her release, Zyra hopes to take her retail experience and work for Goodwill's Now program, which employs the recently incarcerated, thanks to funding from the county and state.
We're actually like recommended to work there and get the experience that we're needed, since it is kind of difficult to get back in the workforce after being released of jail for having a record. So it's pretty nice.
On average, women spend about 6 months at this jail. They often leave in the same clothes they came in wearing. Sometimes they're arrested in the summer, but they're released in the dead of winter, or their clothes just don't fit by the time they get out.
It's called the walk of shame. We have to walk all the way to the light rail from here, and our clothes are either too small or too big.
That's Monica, who also asked to be identified by her first name only for the same reason as Zyra. She says Elmwood's Goodwill program offers her and other women a chance to walk out with some self-respect.
So I'll be able to not only get out and walk with my dignity, I'll be able to get dressed the next day with something else and go and take care of business like I'm supposed to, you know?
Women in the jail say the clothes they came in with are often dirty and the reminder of a life they also may want to leave behind. Captain Rita Rowland helped bring the Goodwill program to Elmwood.
Being able to leave with a fresh start, it makes a difference. When they say clothing matters, it matters. It can have an impact on how you feel about yourself and your outlook, even on life.
I really appreciate you guys.
Oh, thank you. We appreciate you too.
Thank you for your help.
Jessica, the shopper from earlier, brought her haul to the front of the store, where Blanca rang her up, fuzzy cuffed boots, a black backpack, leggings, and a cardigan. But no money was exchanged, as everything is free, just as Jessica plans to be in a few short months. For NPR News, I'm Brian Kranz in Milpitas, California.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From EBSCO, committed to making it easy for people to discover and access library resources anytime from anywhere with bibliograph and linked data technology. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the Will